Welcome, everybody, to another episode of On the Range Podcast with Warhog Tactical and Kelly Defense. I am Mark Kelly, and as always, I am joined by Rick Hogg from Warhog Tactical. How's it going, buddy?
Man, Mark, it is going great. Just want to thank the viewers, listeners out there for giving us your most precious commodity, your time to tune in. Hey, guys, if you like what you're hearing, please do us a big favor. Hit that like button, subscribe button, whatever platform you're listening on. Don't forget, leave us a rating, review. I don't care if it's just a thumbs up emoji. Do something to help us bump this algorithm. And oh, by the way, if you like what you're hearing, you want early access, you want kind of new training videos, you want a Zoom call with me and Mark, go to patreon.com/ontherangepodcast. Again, kind of early access to everything on there. And just want to thank you guys for tuning in and supporting the show.
Yeah, man. Wherever you are, thank you for making this part of your day. And today's episode is brought to you by KillCliff. So go to killcliff.com, use promo code OTR15, save yourself 15% on the entire purchase. Also, while you're there, check out the Cult Club. It's a rewards program. The more you talk about, the more you earn. They have a bunch of great flavors out there. They have a new one called Octane that is both CBD and caffeine. Unbelievable. Great flavors. They have recovery drinks, energy drinks. They use good, clean ingredients and fuel the American dream with ingredients that do not suck. So today, Rick, we have a fantastic guest.
Yeah, I'm super excited to introduce our next guest, man. We've got Stephen Hunter. He is a New York Times best-selling author. He's also an Army veteran, a Pulitzer Prize winner. I mean, he's written over 20 books. He's got the Bob Lee Swaggered novel series. Man, when you get your books made into a movie, it's something else. So super excited to have Stephen on the show.
Yeah, one of the great storytellers. Let's go ahead and let's bring him on. How are you doing today, Stephen?
I'm very well. Thank you guys very much.
No, I just want to say, Stephen, thanks for coming on the show. Thank you for your service. I don't know if a lot of people know you are an Army veteran, so appreciate that. And yeah, man, sorry to cut you off, Mark.
No, go ahead.
Thank you so much. I love being thanked for my service as a veteran because I didn't do anything except sit on my butt for 2 years. So my butt thanks you.
Well, were you actually in the old guard up in D.C.?
I was in the old guard. I was first in Alpha Company at Fort McNair, and then I was moved across the river to headquarters company, where I joined the PIO, Public Information Office, and that's where the real sitting took place.
Now,
I mean,
do you credit
the battle of the chair and I won.
Now, do you credit your development of becoming an author and writer at the PIO, creating all those narratives for the upper chain of command?
It certainly didn't hurt. You learned I think all young men are helped by being in a large illiberal organization that doesn't give a damn about their feelings. And you just have to be somewhere, someplace, and do your job. And nobody is going to ask you how you feel that day.
Yeah.
And 2 years of that, it doesn't hurt anyone. And it helps a lot of people. And to be honest with you, I always say I got more out of the Army than the Army got out of me. And I think that's the case. And I think the discipline that the Army squished into me, it paid off in the long term. And sure, some of the men that I worked with and for were jerks. Some of them were stupid. Some of them didn't get it. That's all right. So what? That's humanity. You know, you're not guaranteed a soft path through life. And dealing with that kind of minor adversity is very good experience, and it almost never does any harm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if your DI takes you into the swamps and drowns you, obviously that's not good, but other than that, you know, it's okay.
Yeah.
So Stephen, your newest book Targeted comes out the 18th of January. You know, super good read. I'm not going to let any secrets out there, but here's the thing. I found it interesting at the kind of the end, your acknowledgments there, you made some good points and talking about just kind of apologizing for not really able to do that good research in Idaho. Just kind of out of curiosity for the viewers, listeners out there, how much research goes into these things? And I think a lot of people would be surprised where, yes, it's your imagination kind of coming up with the storyline, but there's a lot of research that goes in behind these books, isn't there?
Yes, there actually is. But the truth is, via my method of writing, I'm not aware of it. I'm not one of those guys who does the research first. Because if you do the research first, sometimes you never stop researching and you never start writing. My idea is to start the book now. And as I write, I will research. And when I need to know something, the internet is a great device. And I'll look something up and I'll plug it in that day or that afternoon or the next day and keep going, keep moving forward. I do what's called vertical researching as opposed to horizontal researching. I don't do context. I don't do big scope. I don't do big arc. Just as an example, the book that I've just finished is set in the Normandy campaign, July 1944. There must be 10 or 15 books on the Normandy campaign, July 1944. I buy them all. But do I read 15 books? And the answer is, good Lord, no. What I do is I open to the index and I find the part about sniper warfare, which is the subject proper of this new novel, not Targeted, but the next book. And I'll read those 10 pages. And I'll do that for all 10 books. And I'll learn enough to keep going. And then if I don't know something, I will either A, make it up if I have to, but I'll make it up and try and keep it consistent with what I already know so that it doesn't stand. I mean, somebody doesn't show up in Normandy in a 1958 Ford Galaxy. You know, I understand. Now, I might have the guys in a 1944 field code when, in point of fact, the 1944s didn't reach the troops until 1945. That's the kind of mistake I can more or less live with. Though if I catch it, I will fix it and make it a 1943 field code. And they all wore, if you look at the old pictures, all the guys in Normandy in 1944 wore model 1943 field jackets. And getting stuff like that right is a great pleasure to me. But if it doesn't happen, I'm not going to commit suicide. I mean, my job is to keep moving forward, make it as well as good as I can. And, you know, at a certain point, you have to let it go, even though it's flawed. And that's just the reality of the business. And there are just far too many people who have an unreasonable standard of perfection, and they never let it go, and it never gets finished, it never gets published, and all these years later they're still working on their research. So there you have it.
Is that because your focus is on telling the story the way you want to tell it? Is that what
exactly? Okay. I mean, what I'm interested in is sort of the interaction between the people as they progress through the obstacles that the plot puts in front of them. And if I, that's really more important to the book than whether it's a 1943 or a 1944 field jacket. And plus, if I always got the field jackets right, what would people comment on Amazon? You know, I've got to feed that hungry beast out there of show off. Ha! I know something he doesn't know. Those were 1943 jackets, not 1944. You know, and that that's part of the game, I suppose. And I just laugh at it and keep going. And the checks still seem to clear, so I think I'm okay.
Yeah.
So that was great. Stephen, you bring up a great point, and I just want to kind of switch back in time here a little bit. You know, so you figure when you first started writing, I'm sure you were kind of hunting and pecking, or if you were skilled, you know, typing on a typewriter. But when you look at kind of writing when you first started, like how long would it take you to do a novel there versus kind of today with technology?
Accelerated radically. The first book from start to finish was about 2 years. And of course that involved a lot of retyping time. If you went to a second draft, that was literally a second draft, meaning you had to type the whole damn thing over and over. And if you're a less than graceful typist, that was agony, and it was agony for me. And that in itself drove a lot of people out of the business. But now, of course, it's all done in cyberspace. The manuscript is fluid. So if you want to change Bill's name to Sam, you hit one button and then you hit, you know, send, and through 600 pages, all the bills become Sam's. And so it's a lot easier from a technical point of view. And you don't submit a manuscript anymore. You convert it to there's a way, I mean, this, everybody knows this, you can send it to them via email, and all the editing takes place on the screen, and there's no paper. I mean, the first time I see the book on paper is when I get the advanced reader's copy about 6 months before publication. And the book is now a phenomenon of glowing green on a dark background, you know, and it's just, as I say, there's no paper anywhere in the process. And do I miss paper? I don't know, maybe. I remember when I finished, the last book I did that had a paper representation was The Third Bullet. And when I was finally done with it, it was very long, complicated to write. When I was finally done with it, I was taking it to FedEx. And I remember just pausing as I got into my car. And the manuscript was about, 3 to 4 inches thick and weighed about a pound and a half. And I remember thinking, holy cow, did I do all this? And I'd flip the pages. And I'd see, millions of keystrokes. And it was just, there was such a pride in creating the object. And I missed not getting an object out of it. I mean, you sort of connect with certain rituals. And the ritual of sending the manuscript to New York, that was always poignant for me. I mean, I never thought I'd be at this point and where I'd be sending manuscripts to New York. And so when I do it now, or when I did it up until whenever I stopped doing it, it was, it had some weight. It had some autobiographical meaning. And I miss that. I mean, again, the checks seem to still clear. So I don't miss it that much. If the checks stop clearing, that's when I'll start really missing things.
Yeah.
But, it changes. And now you can do start to finish a book in about 6 months. It's just the whole thing has imploded, and it's gotten shorter and shorter and shorter. But the process is still the same: writing, cutting, rethinking, editing, getting other opinions, trying to accommodate suggestions of other people. It's still a narrative process. It's still an editorial process. It's still intellectually, it's the same, even if technically you use a send button instead of the U.S. Postal Service. If you want to play in this game, that's what's got to happen. So shut up about it. Don't play in it. Those are your options.
Just for reference, what was the first style of typewriter? I'm sure it was a typewriter, the first book that you wrote. Did it have the old carriage style going back and forth feel?
And it was an Underwood. And in fact, when I look back on it, my career has it traced the evolution of writing technology.
Yeah.
From manual typewriter to electric typewriter to what were those? There's that IBM thing with the ball.
Yeah.
I can't forget what it was called. And then I went to primitive computer with where you put the discs in. I can't remember what the operate, maybe MOS, something like that.
And the word processors that yeah, they came out
that's
with.
That's it. In my, I found out one thing. It is not a good idea to spill jelly on your discs. And somebody to rescue a disc of mine with about, 400 pages on it that was smeared with jelly. Somehow he managed to save all but one chapter. And of course, to this day, I believe that if he'd been able to save that one chapter, everything would have been different. And I would have been 10 times more successful. But damn it, yeah. I got that one chapter back. So,
oh, that's great.
It just, and then now, of course, I'm working on a dedicated writing machine. Probably needs an update. I haven't updated in about 10 years. It's not connected to the internet, and I like it that way. I leave the internet downstairs because the internet, and for all the good it does a great deal of bad. And the worst thing it does is it is the great distractor, and you're one button away from virtually any place or anything in the world. And that for someone like me, whose grip on discipline is always tangential, that temptation would have destroyed me if I'd encountered it earlier.
Yeah.
And Stephen, I got to tell you, man, tangential. I mean, your vocabulary, just when I opened up the book, right? And it'd been a while since I'd read one of your books. The first thing that struck me is just your use of vocabulary. And a lot of people that aren't readers, they forget that you can increase your vocabulary so much by reading. I just, man, first thing I was like, boom, right there in your face. I mean, have you always been, big in the vocabulary part, or how has all that piece kind of worked?
I hear that fairly frequently. And it's not something I'm really conscious of. It's just who I am and the way I operate. And, maybe I talk and write too fancy. Maybe that's cost me some readers who don't like fancy and who don't like big words. And I don't know, who can say. But it's not a conscious showing off thing. Now, I've written some books in the voice of an Englishman or even a Victorian Englishman, and that in those books, I'm consciously aware of vocabulary and trying to use words, make choices and sentence structure in such a way that it recalls the 19th century. However, when I'm writing, general mainstream fiction, telling general mainstream stories, then I just do what seems best at the time. And whether the vocabulary is elevated or degraded is not something I'm consciously thinking of. It's just pouring straight from my subconscious into through the vessel of my hands to the keys and the keyboard into cyber reality. And it's just how I talk and how I think and how I write. And if I just have the opinion that if I pay too much attention to it, it'll dry up. It's best just to sort of try and do this sort of stuff as unconsciously as possible. Just let it happen between your imagination and the electronic page without a whole lot of stops in between. And then, you can always fix it, sort of. You can make it better. Can you make it great? I don't know. Can you make it a masterpiece? I don't know. It hasn't happened to me yet. But you can take something that's okay and make it good, or you can take something good and make it pretty good. And those are the kind of practical improvements that a professional writer ought to be able to do. And if I'm going to call myself, man, I do this for a living, I better be able to do that. So whether I want to or not, that's part of the obligation of the craft.
Mm-hmm. So writing stories isn't your only gig. You've done journalism as its rawest form as well, correct?
I have indeed. I wrote movie reviews for,
right,
oh gosh, 27 years. I saw 300 movies a year for,
oh my gosh,
for 27 years. I saw way too many movies. At the time, you know, newspapers were different then, and they were much bigger, and they had this huge torrent, this river of money pouring into them called classified ads. Well, all that went away. And so they've had to narrow down. They've had to focus. They've had to cut staff. Everybody on a newspaper now does 4 or 5 jobs. When it used to be, everybody on a newspaper did one half of one job some of the time. And the rest of the time, they hung out at the water cooler or hid in the men's room or patrolled the halls. Or, you know, I mean, they were newspapers were Deadwood farms for years and years. There were, you know, it's like a skeleton. You could fire everybody who had a byline on the paper on a single day and still put out a paper the next day because there'd be enough dead wood left to go into those jobs. Not anymore. Now it's a real sort of desperate scramble to fill the paper every day. To be honest, now that I think about it, I don't think anything I've written has quite caught that reality, the new newspaper as opposed to the old newspaper. Or maybe that would be a kind of an interesting place or way to go. It's that craft, it, like the book writing, has changed enormously over the years. And again, you either adjust or, you know, you retire or resign or sell stocks and bonds or something. It's just change is merciless. It's just like, I'm quoting either Lenin or someone or Trotsky, who said that you may not be interested in history, but history is interested in you. Well, it's also, that can be said of a number of, that structure can be used. And in my life, it's, you may not be interested in change, but change is interested in you. And I've seen vast changes in production come to the newspaper business, and I've seen it destroy generations of men. You know, I mean, when I got to the Sun in the early 70s, all those guys were World War II veterans. All those guys wore coats and ties and worked in them to work. All those guys smoked 2 or 3 packs a day, or cigars or pipes. You know, the newsroom was like, you know, the gas attack at Ypres in 1916. And that's all gone. And that generation, when the computers first came in, many of them conceptually couldn't make the leap. I mean, they were very good journalists. They were very highly skilled at the craft of putting out a hot metal newspaper, meaning a newspaper in which the, you know, it was produced by linotype, and the linotype was slugs of lead with upside down, backwards letters on them. And they could do that in their sleep brilliantly, day after day after day. But suddenly this new thing came along, and just a lot of them could not make the shift. It was just too intimidating for them, and they couldn't really wrap their minds around it. And many, there were, you know, there were some suicides. There were some men who suddenly felt useless, and you know, they finish themselves off rather than confront their uselessness or try to deal with it. And it was sad, but as I say, change is, you may not be interested in it, but it is interested in you.
Yeah.
And you, and so, that's true in all industries. I'm sure it's not unique to journalism by any means. And, you know, one of the things about being a journalist is what happens to us, to journalists, is always far more important than what happens to the truck driver or the farmer, because we don't see that. We see ourselves, you know, that's our first focus. But it's true of everywhere and everything. Mm-hmm.
So, Stephen, what was it like kind of seeing some of your, you know, your books out there actually put into movies? What was that kind of from your standpoint? And then how much were they adjusted, or how much input did you actually have on the studio to make sure that your story was being told in its truest fashion?
I had ceremonial input, meaning they pretended to listen to me. I knew there would come a moment when they stopped returning my calls. And I knew it would be a challenge to,
yeah.
Hey, is Mark Wahlberg no longer my best friend? I knew that day would come. And fortunately, I was old enough so that I didn't take it personally. I thought it was kind of funny. And here's what I have a stock line about the movie business, and it's for a writer. You're not being paid in money. You may get some money, but what you're really being paid in is funny stories to tell your friends. And you get a lot of those because it's a it's a daffy business. It's a strange business. It doesn't really make a lot of sense. A lot of crazy things happen. It's just, you know, it's, I don't know why it developed into the way it did. And in fact, one of the guys, a big producer, said to me, he said, you know, this is the strangest way to do business in the world, and yet it works. I mean, that's why we do it in this crazy way. And it's, they don't, no. So the answer to the question is no, they didn't really listen to me. I tried, they stopped listening to me when I saw the finished product, and they had trouble with the ending. And in fact, it's as recently as the, when they made the preview, they had a different ending on the movie. And if you see the preview, it's got a scene in the movie. It's got a scene in the preview that doesn't occur in the movie. They had trouble with the original ending that didn't test well. So very late in the process, they shot another ending. That's the ending where Bob Lee goes to the house in the wood and murders everybody. Well, that's not very Bob Lee, you know, he wouldn't do that, but they didn't care at that point. They just had to have a movie. They just had to have an ending on this movie that tested well. So they stuck that on, and I tried to get them to change it. I put together a memo. I told them what they could do in instead, you know, and how they could cut it and shift it, and, you know, nothing. Nothing. It's just that's when the return phone calls stopped coming. I'll say they treated me very well. They treated me with respect. At one point, Mark Wahlberg said to me, "Mr. Hunter, gee, I hope we get to make all your books into movies." And I said to him, "Me too. Me too. I really hope that too." But it wasn't to be. And again, that's, you have to play it as it lays, and that's the way it lays, and no sense getting upset about it. The best thing to do is just to keep moving ahead, and at the end of the day, maybe you can look back on a career and take some pleasure in that.
Yeah. Well, the go ahead, Rick.
No, you go, Mark.
The movie business, now getting into that, is it something that you were looking to do, or did you find that any more satisfying that your story was being told to a different media like film rather than people having to read the book? Did you feel anything a little bit More satisfying than winning some kind of award or bestseller?
No, not really. I knew, you know, every writer wants a movie made because you reach a wider audience and it sends people back to the original book to some degree. It makes you, you know, I was famous for 3 months. I had 3 months of fame, and that was kind of fun. I get to walk on the red carpet with nice. My wife and daughter. But I knew it would be a rough process. I knew that at a certain point they would panic and do what they thought was best, regardless of what I said. You know, in other words, I knew that my shelf lifetime was very limited out there, and I was okay with that. I was old enough so that I didn't have to take it personally. I didn't have to get depressed about it. I did not see the movie as the ultimate end. I didn't write the books to get movies made. I wrote the books because I seem to have a gift for it, and I don't feel complete unless I'm using that gift, however great or small it might be, to its fullest extent. So when it came to the movieization process, I knew it would have a lot of pitfalls. I knew that some of the people would be treacherous. I didn't know that all of the people would be treacherous. And when I sort of finally got quit of it, I felt not disappointment, but relief. And I said, you know, I don't really belong in that world. I'm much better off in a room with a keyboard than in a room with 10 strange people giving me contradictory advice. And, you know, I'm better off in a room where if I say it rains, I have to type, 8 letters, ITRAINS, it rains. Whereas if I write it rains in a movie script, that's an expenditure of, you know, $750,000. Where does that fit into the budget? Where can we shoot that scene? Where can we, you know, and there's all sorts of logistical and other considerations. I wrote a book called The Day Before Midnight. And at one point, one of the producers says, oh, by the way, instead of midnight, we've decided to make it noon. Well, the point of the book was midnight, you know, built on the model of midnight. And I tried to explain to him, no, it can't be noon. That's not the idea. And the only thing he saw was what was more likely to get the movie made. What script was more likely to get green-lighted by the big bosses? And a script set at noon, which was much cheaper to shoot, was more likely. So that was his only reality. And to me, that was ludicrous. But we were just speaking in such different languages that there was really, I mean, it was kind of funny. It was like two warships going in opposite directions in the fog, passing each other a mile apart. And seeming to communicate, but not really communicating at all. That's a funny story that I got out of my movie experience. And let me guess that the next question is, are any of your other books going to be made into movies? And the answer is probably not. You really only get one swing at bat. And although Point of Impact, or as they call it, Shooter, has become sort of a cult favorite. And in fact, it was on the Paramount Channel last night, I happened to notice. It didn't generate enough in overall world profits to make a sequel and to make the other books possible. Now, it did spin off into USA TV series with Ryan Phillippe for 3 years, and I made some more money off of that. But as I watched, it got further and further from the books until it was set on a different planet. You know, instead of setting the day before midnight at noon, they took it off of planet Earth and moved it to planet Dune. And at that point, I couldn't stay with it. You know, its connection to what I had written had gotten very, very, thin, and it didn't seem to need my eyes to validate it. So I stopped watching it.
Speaking of being on Paramount last night, you seeing any royalties from that?
Yeah, I do. In fact, the other day I got a check for 0.9 cents. Literally, I mean, I'm not joking. And I took it to the bank and put it in the check, you know, machine. And because I knew that if I didn't, it would screw up Hollywood. You know, if I don't cash my check for 9 cents, Hollywood falls. And I didn't want to have that on my conscience. And the bank couldn't really believe it. They double checked to make sure that I was cashing a check for 9 cents. But again, that's the computer. Doesn't matter to the computer if it's 9 cents or $9 million. It's just no sum is more valuable than any other sum to the computer. And the computer determined that I had earned 9 cents in royalties for that property for that period of time. And so, but actually, I don't think it was a royalty. It was a payment for my appearance in the TV show. Everyone gets royalties. I had flown up to Vancouver and filmed a little 3-minute, maybe not even that long, guest appearance as the gun store owner. I still get royalties for that, 9 cents being the last royalty. I couldn't begin to justify it, but as I say, the check did clear. And there's 9 cents to burn on Vice or whatever.
Yeah. So if you want to talk about this book, was this something, because you already said that you're working on your next book, are these just keep coming out? Or do you just keep until the story's over or you decide you're done?
Well, I've sort of screwed up accidentally my own, the rate of books I'm publishing. I inserted a book in the process that kind of pushed everything else out further. And that book was a book I did last year called Basil's War. And that was based on a shorter book that I'd already written, but I was asked to expand it. And it took a month. You know, it wasn't 6 months. It wasn't a year. It was a month. But it was important to me. I liked the book. I liked the character. I liked the period. I liked the language. I thought it had some kind of potential. So I went to all sorts of trouble, and it cost me some money, I might add, to get that book published. And that pushed everything behind it back further. So now I'm ahead of the game. And this book, Targeted, was originally supposed to come out last fall. And because of that insertion of Basil's War, it has been pushed back, about 5 months? And I'm not sure that did me any good. I'm not sure how that's going to play out, if that's for good or for bad from a market point of view. And then when I was done with Targeted, I had, as I say, this World War II novel that I really was anxious to write. And I went right ahead and wrote it. And because it was so much fun, I worked really hard on it. And I got it done rather quickly. So it'll be published not this year, but sometime next year. And so the book I'm working on now will actually be my 2024 book. So, the time between writing and publishing has gotten, even with the technology involved, it's gotten longer, not shorter. And that, you know, as I say, that's that. Deal with it or get out, you know, don't cry about it. And we're just, you know, we just hit the keyboards and try and turn out stories that people will like. And that's the only thing I can do. I mean, I don't know how to do anything right. else. I can't make them publish it. It's their publishing house, not mine. And they make those decisions. They might pretend to listen to me, but they really don't. So there you go. Yeah.
Where can everybody find the book? I know that it's coming out on Amazon.
It actually makes its physical appearance in the bookstores on January 18th. That's number one. Number two, on all the big book selling mail organizations like Amazon and B&N and some of the others will send it out the day before so that it should arrive on the 18th. So the world now has no targeted books in it. It will have on Tuesday of next week, as I now speak, it will have many issues of targeted next Tuesday. That's where the physical book becomes available.
Awesome.
I think this one is a lot of fun. People seem to, what I keep hearing over and over again is, I couldn't put it down. They never tell you when they could put it down. You know, boy, could I ever put that one down? But they do seem to say, I mean, it's written to be very fast moving. It's written to be very engaging. It's, you know, really written to be read in one sitting. And as I say, I hope people like it. It is, among other things, I think it's kind of funny. And I think people will enjoy this sort of mixture of humor and horror. That's sort of the modern world we live in. And it was that rhythm that I was kind of interested in taking. I will say that Bob is old. Bob doesn't have much. He doesn't kick down any doors or climb any stairways. He has to get his breath now and then. But he's still pretty smart. And he can still figure stuff out.
So, Stephen, just...
Yeah, exactly. And he hurts every place. You know, his legs hurt, his hips hurt, his arms hurt, his hands hurt. But he keeps on trucking, you know, because that's his idea of doing what he was supposed to do. Yeah. Basically, the setup is he is indicted. No, he's not indicted. He's called before a congressional committee. And a lot of people who have never been in action set about to judge him for what he did in action. And they think they know what he should have done as opposed to what he did do. And that's always offended me. That happens in America all the time. I mean, most recently, this police officer in, I guess, Wisconsin, see, what was her name? I can't remember. Melissa Potts. She grabbed the taser. She grabbed the Glock instead of the taser, and she was found guilty. Well, she was in the middle of a fight, and you really can't judge her unless you've been in a desperate fight. And your mind works differently in a desperate fight than it does sitting behind a desk or in front of a camera. And she ought to be judged by people who've been in desperate fights because they know what's possible. But instead, she's judged by people who know nothing. And that has always struck me as wrong. And that is that's the gist of this book. The people who judge him suddenly need him. He goes from being an outcast to their best friend in the world because he's the only one who can save their bacon from the fire. And it was great fun writing that. You know, it was great fun watching the worm turn and watch the masters of the universe suddenly become pawns of the universe and turn to the good man with the gun to save their bacon. Well, I'm mixing metaphors. Save their wormhood from some very bad guys.
How did Bob Lee come about and character for so long?
It was a long time ago, and the results, my memories are sort of hazy, but I had encountered Carlos Hathcock, and I was very moved by that book, even if I thought there were some things in it that were probably exaggerated. And I wanted to do a story about a sniper, and I wanted it to be based on Carlos Hathcock. And I had, in another area of my life, I encountered a situation in which someone was hired, a professional shooter was hired to recreate for a ballistics laboratory the geometry, riflery and ballistics of the Kennedy assassination, but on scaffolding, not in a city. You know, in other words, all the distances were the same and all the angles were the same and the target was moving at the same speed. And he was using the Mannlicher Carcano 6.5, but he was on a scaffolding in the middle of the Maryland woods, H.B. White Ballistics Laboratory. And that image, I thought how I could combine the two of those is the beginning of a story. And really, without too much more than that, I started to write, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote, and I wrote. And the years passed, and all my hair fell out, and I had no idea what I was doing. And a very good editor at Bantam, Ann Harris, sort of saved the book for me. She went through it very assiduously, and she bought into it, even though it wasn't probably her cup of tea. She's a sophisticated New York editorial type. She didn't know anything about guns, but she let me have my head, and she understood that I was at my best when the gun was primary to my imagination. And we eventually got it ironed out. There was a time when I stopped working on it, and I worked on, this was another Hollywood misadventure, I worked on a screenplay and story conferences for a version of my book that was never made called The Day Before Midnight. That was where someone said, oh, make it The Day Before Noon. And, yeah. Anyway, I had to come back to it, and I'm not sure if that didn't help it. You know, getting away from it sometimes and forgetting it and then coming back to it fresh probably helps a narrative more than it hurts it. And that book, you know, at one point I had to cut 200 pages. Whenever I didn't know what to do, I wrote either a meeting or a gunfight, whether it needed it or not. So in the end, I had 800 pages of meetings and gunfights and no story. And so at one point I realized I was at page 450 and there hadn't been a crime yet. You know, it helps if there's a crime somewhere in these books. I just kept hammering, beating my head against it over the years. And I, at a point specifically revolving around Bob, in order to make him real, it's not that he was based on Carlos, but I had to break him away from Carlos and make him my character. And that's why I invented the backstory. That's why I invented the Swagger family. That's why I invented his father, Earl. That's why I made Polk County, Arkansas, which I'd never heard of before I started, a kind of, like Yaknepetofa, like Faulkner's Yaknepetofa County, the origin and the history and the families going back over the years. And all of that stuff was not planned. And another interesting thing is Nick Memphis, the character, Bob's sidekick through many an adventure. I don't like sidekicks. I don't like books with sidekicks. And I hadn't planned to write one. And somehow Bob ended up with a sidekick. I don't know where it came from. It's not
You got to work Nick Memphis in there somewhere. You can't let that name go.
It's not a 600 book without Nick Memphis. And I still am trying to figure out what his name means. Is he Egyptian? I don't know. So maybe he's from Tennessee. Anyway, stuff happens. And you improvise, you make things up, you make changes, you deviate from the outline, you return to the outline. It's not a clear process. It is just a process of getting through it. And sometimes it's ugly. It's like a football game. You never know in which quarter if some things work and other things don't. And you hope at the end of the day, more things work than didn't work. And, that's all that you just do it. You just keep bumbling along, and you hope that in the end you have enough skill to make it interesting enough for someone to publish. And yeah, that's all my books have been written with that in mind, with that goal, not to just to get the damn thing done and out is the point. It's no point in doing it if it sits on a computer file forever and ever.
So, yeah.
Trying to be a professional is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Man, that's awesome. I mean, and here's the beauty, Stephen, is you don't have to worry about having any jelly hopefully smeared on the disc so that you have all your content there.
I have learned, however, to keep jelly out of the computer room. You know, it's just on sound principle.
Well, we really appreciate you being here. I'm sure your promotion tour and all that stuff's getting ramped up, and it's just been a pleasure letting us pick your brain. And you just do a magnificent job of telling stories. And the nice thing, it's like golf. You know, you can do it the rest of your life. You know what I mean? You don't have to quit, and we hope that you don't. So
I don't either, because it keeps my brain more or less organized. And I want to thank you guys. Great questions. I hope I didn't talk too long. I hope you enjoyed it and your listeners enjoyed it. And, I believe me, I appreciate the assist it'll give me in getting the thing before the public.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And thank you for your service again. Really appreciate it, Stephen. So, just don't hang up yet. We're going to go ahead and wrap this up, and we'll sidebar, but appreciate you having you on the show.